Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm David Bowes, your host. A recent piece in the Smithsonian Magazine on continental drift offers some parallels and possible lessons for proponents of intelligent design. Here to talk about it with me is the Discovery Institute's Casey Luskin. Casey, you caught this Smithsonian Magazine article about when continental drift was considered pseudoscience, and that surprised me. I never even knew that it was considered pseudoscience because I look at a globe and it looks like a jigsaw puzzle already. It's one of those things where the evidence of this looks to be overwhelming right from the start. Why was it considered pseudoscience to begin with? What was the controversy about it?
Well, initially, because proponents of continental drift were unable to provide a mechanism to explain how the continents could move, they were harshly criticized by the mainstream geological community of that day. And also because continental drift happened so slowly, folks couldn't observe it in real time, and they thought, surely this is not the way geology proceeds. I mean, you can observe very slowly that a river can cut through a riverbed, but it's much more difficult to observe in real time the continents moving. So there was a lot of skepticism when this theory was first proposed in the early 1900s.
How did that theory start to take hold? Since the proponent of the original theory was mocked, when did that stop and what triggered it?
Well, the original proponent of continental drift was a German scientist named Alfred Wegener. And anybody who studies geology will immediately learn about Wegener's story. I certainly did when I was an undergraduate and grad student taking lots of courses in continental drift and plate tectonics, which, by the way, I think the evidence for continental drift and plate tectonics is just overwhelmingly compelling. I always have. I think that it's one of the best and most fascinating scientific theories out there. But he was ridiculed. Wegener, when he first put out this idea, he was absolutely ridiculed by the scientific community. And this Smithsonian Magazine article talks about it quite a bit. People called his ideas delirious ravings, and they claimed that he had moving crust disease and wandering pole plague. And the article talks about how people attacked his scientific credentials and claimed that he wasn't a real scientist or that he didn't have the credentials in the appropriate fields to actually understand these kinds of questions. And this was in the early 1900s. And Wegener, to his credit, he stuck to his guns and he promoted his ideas in the face of harsh criticism for decades. Now, the irony here is that it was not until the 1960s that continental drift was finally accepted by mainstream geology. And by that time, Alfred Wegener had long since passed away, and so he did not actually live to see his theory receive ultimate vindication, as the article puts it. But I think what this story tells us is that sometimes ideas that are correct can receive very, very harsh treatment by the scientific community. People can be mocked and ridiculed, and there can be no sign that they're going to let up. And then ultimately, you get some new evidence, and the tables can turn overnight, and scientific revolutions can take place, leading to total changes in the mindset of an entire field.
It seems shocking that it would take generations for this theory to take hold. And then, as you say, once there's an overwhelming amount of support for it, or at least it reaches that tipping point, then suddenly, like something falling over an edge, it all moves very quickly after that. But there's a pattern in science where scientific theories get mocked and ridiculed until finally people take a new look at it.
The lesson from continental drift is that just because the scientific community has been ridiculing you, even for 2 to 3 generations, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're wrong. You might still turn out to be right. And so, obviously, intelligent design is a relatively young scientific field, I would say, and is certainly receiving very harsh treatment from its overconfident critics who will quite confidently assert that we're ignorant, we lack appropriate credentials, all kinds of mockery and ridicule. If the lesson from the continental drift story means anything, none of that means that intelligent design doesn't hold merit, and it may ultimately turn out to be the right idea. It might take a long time. It may take 50-plus years for the scientific revolution to fully take place, but it doesn't mean that you're wrong. It means that you need to look at the evidence and let the evidence determine your beliefs, not what other people are saying, not ridicule, not the fact that your view may or may not be the consensus. The evidence should be letting you decide what you believe, and you should be following the evidence where you think it leads and not just following the crowd. And thankfully, Alfred Wegener didn't do that. He followed the evidence, not peer pressure and not the crowd. And as a result, geology underwent huge scientific changes in the 1960s. And I should point out, Dave, that it's not the case that the evidence that ultimately caused many folks in the scientific community to change their minds didn't exist when Wegener first was promoting his theory. You mentioned the fit of the continents. Well, Wegener knew about that, and so did all the scientists of his day. And when you read an introductory geology textbook, they will always cite the fit of the continents as one of the foundational pieces of evidence for continental drift. So that was there for years. And yes, there was new data that came in the 1960s. It had a lot to do with magnetic seafloor stripes on the seafloor, which seemed to confirm the motion of the continents and really fulfilled some very specific predictions of the continental drift theory. But a lot of the evidence was there in Wegener's time. It was nothing new, and folks just didn't want to hear about it because it was a new idea that challenged their convention. It challenged the consensus, and so they were very intolerant of those new ideas, as scientists often are. So I think that we might find that a lot of the evidence that's being cited for ID today, the bacterial flagellum, this data is not going to change, but maybe 50 years from now, we're going to find that there's totally different interpretations of the data, and the bacterial flagellum's irreducible complexity turns out to be accepted by the majority of the scientific community.
Why do you think it is, with the history of science being littered with examples like this, where an orthodoxy is challenged, it's mocked, it's savaged, and then eventually it appears that the scientific minds of the day were actually ignoring evidence and not exploring the idea? We have this cultural idea of scientists being disinterested observers, only interested in what the facts are, and yet it seems like pride is still getting in the way. Why do you think it is these lessons of the past haven't taken hold?
We're human. All scientists are human. Whether you're in the consensus or not, you're a human being, which means that sometimes you don't always respond in the best way to evidence and ideas that challenge your personal view of reality. Unfortunately, in the scientific community, there does tend to be a lot of groupthink. Now, I'm not somebody who thinks that the consensus is always wrong. I mean, hardly. I think that plate tectonics, which today is the consensus, is an extremely well-supported scientific theory. So sometimes the consensus is right, sometimes it's wrong. I think the safeguard that we need to have in place for ourselves is to not let the fact that something is or is not the consensus be a factor in whether we decide that we agree with a particular idea. What should be the determining factor should be the evidence. And you should follow the evidence where it leads, regardless of what is or is not popular in the scientific community. And I think if all scientists let that be sort of their guiding principle, then there would be a lot more tolerance, there'd be a lot less ridicule, and there perhaps would be a lot more accuracy in terms of what scientists believe. People like to say science is a self-correcting enterprise. I would like to think that it is, but you know what? From 1910 to 1960, with regards to continental drift, it wasn't. So for 50 years, science was not correcting itself. And thankfully it did, but kind of makes you wonder, are we in that intermediate stage where science hasn't self-corrected on some important ideas today? Maybe neo-Darwinian evolution is one of them. After all, we see Darwinian evolutionists certainly using a lot of ridicule and a lot of demeaning tactics against their critics to sort of keep them from gaining prestige and clout in the scientific community. So the fact that Darwinian evolution today is the consensus might just be a reflection of the intolerance that's going on out there. I'm not saying that folks don't have a strong belief in Darwinian evolution, and they will certainly cite evidence in favor of it, but I think the fact that it is the consensus view may reflect some of these sociological factors in many respects.
Yeah, I would suppose it is important not to dismiss the consensus view or the dominant view in any major field, because obviously you've got the great minds working on the problem, but it also shows that ad hominem attacks and ridicule shouldn't be the factors that get you to stop exploring an issue.
Yeah, that's right. But this is really an encouraging story for proponents of intelligent design. It might be the case that it's not for a few decades that ID receives ultimate vindication, but this story says that we may have to endure a lot of ridicule in the meantime. This doesn't mean that ID is wrong. And in fact, in the case of continental drift and Alfred Wegener, it meant that they were right. And so we just need to be willing to follow the evidence where it leads and not let ourselves be bullied by the way we're treated or what the consensus does or doesn't do.
Casey Luskin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That concludes this edition of ID the Future. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting the work of the Center for Science and Culture. Go to idthefuture.com and click the yellow donate button. This podcast is copyright 2012, The Discovery Institute, all rights reserved.